Atlantic storms. HMS Agamemnon, 1858, and Scotland, 1861. The undersea adventure that finally resolved Faraday's hunches began with one Cyrus West Field, who was musing on a cool January afternoon in 1854 before an ornate globe in the library of his New York brownstone. The telegraph to which Morse had put his name was 10 years old. Thomas Edison was just a 7-year-old boy in Michigan. Field had made a fortune in business, but although he was supposedly retired, he was still only in his mid-30s, and he didn't especially like being retired. He'd tried explorations to South America, but those were just guided tours for rich men, and the incident when he'd brought both a jaguar and an apparently nonviolent Amazonian teenager back to New York City didn't bear remembering. He'd also tried spending time in the social world of high-caste New York, of the sort the novelist Edith Wharton would later write about, but the obsessions with tea and gossip had convinced him that the Amazon was not so bad after all. Now, in his study, he noticed something annoying about the globe. On one side there was England and its empire, the great source of proper white culture, while far away, isolated by a vast ocean, there was America. Why should these two natural allies be so crudely separated? The only way to send messages between them was by ship, and it could take weeks to make a round trip between the two nations' capitals. In the past, that had produced great misunderstandings. The Great Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 had lost some of its grandeur when the British and American forces involved were informed that the war they were ostensibly fighting had ended several weeks before. The news had taken that long to reach deep into the South. By the 1850s, those problems were being remedied when it came to land communications. Most great cities with an overland route between them were linked by telegraph: Washington and Baltimore, Paris and Berlin. A few telegraph lines had even been dipped for a few miles underwater, as with the line that had been operating for several years now across the English Channel. But the great challenge, the chief remaining adventure Field realized, was the colossal stretch of the North Atlantic. Its surface was rolling and treacherous for thousands of miles, but underneath, far in the depths, was it not possible that the advanced electrical works of man, lowered cautiously to these regions, might survive untouched for decades on end? Many individuals may have had this vision. In just a few years, the young Frenchman Jules Verne would come up with his Captain Nemo stories about a brilliant sea captain and an advanced submarine that spends months at a time in these depths. But Field had the money to make this vision of connecting the two continents come true. He would build a cable, he decided, a giant ocean-spanning cable, and he would link the two great empires, and he would produce universal brotherhood, or at least great profit, and in doing so, he would get to leave this cursed brownstone and the rituals of stuffy New York life, and instead travel to the world's financial center, London, and work with engineers and sailors and salty sea captains. It turned out to be agonizingly harder than he thought. Over the next 15 years, Field made dozens of crossings of the Atlantic, vomiting almost every time. There were cables that cost millions of pounds sterling that snapped far from shore. There were high storms, and swindlers, and parliamentary inquests, and an attack by a whale, and an embarrassing occasion when New York's City Hall nearly burned down. But even if Field had known all that, he probably still would have gone ahead. It was better than being bored. And what did financial loss, whale attacks, and seasickness mean against the hope of glory? Most of all, in his heart, Field believed the actual technical operation was going to be easy. To him, the cable was like a hose or a narrow tunnel. Electric currents were some sort of crackling, hissing stuff that batteries mysteriously created. He'd just pour that into the hose. If the signal that emerged at the far end of his cable was too weak, well, he'd simply pour in more. Ultimately, Field realized that there was far more to what happened, but for now, when he arrived in London in 1854, resplendent in the best outfit his New York tailors could prepare, he received the eager welcome that any confident American with a great sum to invest is accorded. Field was polite enough, but he had made his way up in the New York textile and paper trade, where trust in human intentions was rewarded with extinction. And, like the majority of Americans arriving in London with a great deal of money to invest, he was quite aware that most of the people he met were trying to take him for a fool. He didn't commit himself, and discreetly sought out the leading electricity theorist in the country, just to be sure his views were right.